When you've got a lot on your plate, your financial future is the last thing on your mind. You've got groceries to buy, gas tanks to fill, and your kid just got invited to another birthday party. How are you supposed to find the time or the money to invest? Let Acorns help. Acorns makes it easy to invest for you, your kids, and your retirement all in one app. Answer a few questions, and Acorns will recommend an expert-built portfolio that matches your money goals. Then, Acorns automatically invests your money for you, every day, week, or month, whatever works for you. You can even start investing with your own spare change. Acorns is an easy way to invest for your future while you take care of today. Ready to give your money a chance to grow? Download Acorns now and sign up in just 5 minutes. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. Please consider your objectives, risk tolerance, and Acorns fees before investing. Acorns Advisors LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are provided to clients of Acorns by Acorns Securities LLC. Member FINRA SIPC. For more information, visit acorns.com.
Three reasons why your kiddo will love Kate Farms Kids Nutrition Shakes. For starters, each nutrient-dense kids shake is made with love for your child's growth and development. Each carton contains 8 grams of plant-based protein plus 27 vitamins and minerals. Secondly, with 3 tasty flavors to choose from in strawberry, chocolate, or vanilla, even the pickiest eaters approve. Lastly, each Kate Farms Kids Shake comes ready to drink with a resealable twist-off cap, great for the car or their lunchbox. Give your kids the quality nutrition they deserve. Get 25% off your first purchase with code AUDIO. Exclusions may apply. See katefarms.com. For details.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
When the Santa's hell.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Contra, the podcast of AmericanPartisan.org and brought to you by BrushBeater.store. It's really good to be back with all of you again. Of course, you're probably noticing that the elite microphone that I have for the show is still not yet on the air. I'm missing a couple of pieces for it in the move and been trying to isolate, figure out where that is on top of everything else. And it has been absolutely wild on this end. That ain't going to keep things down. Okay. That ain't going to keep us down. That ain't going to keep us off the air. Come hell or high water, we are on the air. It is great to be back with all of you out there. We wrapped up Fighting Carbine last weekend. So Saturday, Sunday, it was hot. But we had 24 trigger pullers down on the range. An incredible class. Great fellowship. And I want to say, I'm going to be talking about in this episode some takeaways from Fighting Carbine. There's always a lot of lessons to be taken away from that I like sharing with a larger community, because everybody likes to talk about firearms knowledge and, you know, kind of sharing that wisdom is a topic everybody loves. And it is something that I happen to know a whole heck of a lot about. But, we're going to be diving into that. First, I want to give a huge rest in peace icon. We an American treasure has passed on in the way of Donald Sutherland. And I wanted to give a real quick shout out to Donald Sutherland, who, I think over the years, he's been in a few of my all time favorite films, The Dirty Dozen and Kelly's Heroes, you know, he's absolutely what a wonderful actor, a wonderful man by all accounts. His son, Kiefer Sutherland, who's a legend in and of his own right, seems, you know, like a solid guy as well. Didn't ever really seem like the Hollywood cult latched on to these guys. And they were able to kind of fly above the fray on a lot of stuff and still be very successful in their own right. So big shout out to him. You know, I think Donald Sutherland, I have to give a shout out to an account on Twitter. Blue, I think, is the one of the old hand SF guys out there. But he said that, you know, talking about Donald Sutherland, that he played the E4 Mafia to a T. And man, that cracked me up. That made me smile because that is a fact. That is an absolute fact. And man, I tell you, if you know, you go back and you watch Kelly's Heroes and everybody, it doesn't matter, you know, what unit you were in, but like at the height of the GWAT when, you know, you had those just dead end spec fours, like they know they're never getting promoted. They don't care. They're, you know, and they kind of march to their own drummer, but those are the guys that you want to take to war. Okay. You know, I want to be very blunt about pointing that out. Those are the guys that you want to take to war. Cause you just love them, you know, and they are your fighters without a doubt. Those are your fighters. They are the hard-nosed bastards who are going to win that battle, but they're not there to make things a career. You know, they don't play the politics game and, you know, the unit politics game you always end up with. I knew many, many guys like that. I mean, at one point in time, you know, I was kind of sort of falling into that trap myself. And, you know, I had some career development types kind of pull me out of that, get my head out of my fourth point of contact. But, you know, point is, though, is that I don't think that there was ever an actor or the roles that he played that ever portrayed that quite that well. So to that unnamed gentleman who is an Army retiree, an SF guy that pointed that out, I think that was spot on, absolutely spot on. I mean, even down to, you know, his role in the Dirty Dozen, you know, how he you know, the incredible scene where you've got Lee Marvin, you've got, you know, Lee Marvin's absolute legend, Marine Corps scout sniper in the Pacific, goes to Hollywood, didn't play by anybody's rules there. He was one of the original Hollywood bad boys, and he's up there with Charles Bronson and Telly Savalas and John Cassavetes and Jim Brown, right? Just this incredible, incredible cast of real life badasses, you know. And he's getting to play the role of a general when everybody knows that he's you know he's PFC or private that was on death row. You know, but all of a sudden he's got to pretend in the scene, he's got to pretend that he's a general, in front of this crack unit of some of the best paratroopers in the 101st that are all out there. You know, Robert Ryan was their brigade commander. And, so he's their CO and he's floating around and like, man, this guy's a general, you know, it was just a great scene. And again, you know, Dirty Dozen, one of my two all-time favorite films, it and Where Eagles Dare. Those two, anytime those two are on, I'm going to stop. I'm going to watch those. Been my favorites since I was a kid. And, but anyway, I digress. Donald Sutherland, an incredible actor by all accounts, a great man, not somebody who bought into the Hollywood BS a lot of times and kind of played the game his own way. rest in peace, and we will see you on the other side. So anyway, wanted to get that out of the way. Americana is critically important, and we don't have stars like that today. We don't have, in the Call to Hollywood, we don't have stars like that. They don't create unique personalities that transition into film like that. We just don't do that anymore. Everybody is so damn scared of being offended by every damn thing. And, everything is touchy-feely and, marketability of different people. And that generation didn't give a damn about any of that. I mean, they did, but obviously they did, but it was, they didn't give a damn. If it offended people, so what? Who cares? If you don't like something, don't watch it. And, if you don't like certain actors, whatever, man, they weren't sitting there playing that game. And a lot of these guys had combat experience behind them, or they had served and knew that people had died. There were losses. It was just such a different thing. And I think overall, despite the fact that, you had a lot of political turmoil in that era and a lot of social upheaval, at the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of Americans had a view that America's best days were ahead of it, and that we were working in that direction. We just don't have that today. For a lot of reasons, we don't have that. I think it's unfortunate. And it's something that I'm trying to fight against, that I rail against repeatedly. But, nonetheless, here we are. And so, anyway. The Alex Jones case continues to grind on. This is something when I was on with Colonel Murray, I think it was Friday before last, and the news broke regarding the Alex Jones bankruptcy case, his personal bankruptcy case, that he had to liquidate all of his personal assets. And I told the world, I told all of you, and then, of course, I got on a podcast and explained it as well, that this was the worst possible outcome. Now, I understand that a lot of people looking at it from a glass half full kind of aspect, and maybe not necessarily familiar with how bankruptcies, be it Chapter 11 or Chapter 13, necessarily work. But they also don't understand, in addition to that, they don't understand the reality of what happens when someone is out to shut you down. By hook or by crook, they are going to shut you down. They are going to use every avenue of approach. And I said that when they come after his personal assets first, that is so it strengthens the case against InfoWars itself, is saying that this is his sole means of income, and that it is making money, and because he is the beneficiary of that company, or he's reaping the benefits of it, that in and of itself entails a legal avenue for them to pursue him. And we know that it was a federal bankruptcy case. The Department of Justice is certainly involved in this, and it would be a very smart guess to say that they are involved in it. And when we look at the level of collusion that has happened between the Biden administration and the Department of Justice, I think, which is a all-time criminal level. It is an all-time criminal level what these people are doing. But they are no less doing it. Me pointing it out is not going to change what is, and that is what it is. And so they've strengthened now their case against InfoWars, and it is looking, unfortunately, like InfoWars will likely be shut down. It is looking very likely like that is. And I pray that I'm wrong about that. But one of the trustees of the federal bankruptcy trial of this case has said that their stated goal is shutting down InfoWars. This is what they want to do. So you can take that how you will. I think that it is a sad day in America. It is the death of free speech. And, you know, and I want to point something out here, because there's been a lot of liberals who've been cheering this on. There's been a lot of communists out there that have been cheering this on, too. And it's two very different groups of people. But a lot of you liberals out there, you government cheerleaders, quote unquote, a lot of you with the Ukrainian flags in your bios, which is, you know, kind of a warning sign, I think, nature's warning sign. You know, you people are perfectly fine with fascism as long as it's your brand of fascism. You're perfectly fine with it. You know, I pointed out on a piece that Emerald Robinson put up just yesterday, which a lot of you National Socialist types, the goose steppers out there, decided you wanted to chime in on. And that's fine. It's your prerogative to do so, and you seem to be perfectly fine with being uneducated and ignorant as well on philosophy, on political theory, on social theory, and that's fine. We all have a First Amendment right to be wrong. But I have a high degree of education, and the degrees to back it up, and you don't. So there's that. And if you look at my level of influence and how successful I've been in a relatively short amount of time and how successful all of you aren't, well, you know, then there you go. But this is where we find ourselves. The folks on the right who point to the apparent intermarriage of governance and private organizations and private corporations that wield so much power, they mistakenly label this communism. It is not communism. This is not communism by any stretch of the imagination. There has been no revolution where the bourgeois class have been murdered wholesale. Now, are there some adherents, maybe some of the actors involved in this that would be, at least at the outset, tacitly cheering this on? Sure, maybe. But as soon as their quality of life is interrupted, and it would very well be by a lot of the drug-addled denizens of Antifa and the people who actually make up the militant left, all of a sudden things are going to change. And as many people have been very adept to point out, that's when the hammer of justice of their created organizations, their created lapdogs, that's when all of a sudden they're going to be putting it out there. That's all of a sudden when the hammer is going to drop. Fascism is when you do not have a distinction between private interests and governance, when the two have intermarried, and they use that power to stifle any challenge to that very same. Do you understand what I'm telling you? A lot of the quote-unquote fascists in America who like to fancy themselves as fascists are really just people who are disaffected, right, for one reason or another. And I'm not saying that maybe some of their claims aren't valid. I think that they are, okay? But at the same time, that viewpoint taints the overall understanding of the fact that you are living in a fascist state, and that version of fascism does not benefit you. In fact, it is weaponized against you. You know, we really have a hard time understanding this because you were never taught anything other than what you have been subject to. And when we listen to certain influencers online who really don't know what they're talking about and aren't particularly smart, they may have a polished presentation, but they're not particularly smart. That'll lead us to reinventing the wheel repeatedly. And when the wheel is repeatedly reinvented, we end up with the same problems over and over and over again, to include the same pitfalls repeatedly. And that is where we are. All right, that is where we are. This is the reason that at Joe Biden's inauguration, they had more American flags out there than anything else, okay? Than anything. That was all you saw. Of course, you didn't see any people there. But all you saw were American flags. And what that was the Politburo that's really running things in America saying, we are now back in charge. We have the power. We took it before your very eyes. And you no longer have it. We played your little game. We overlooked one election that we thought was in the bag so that our president we were going to install, Hillary Rodham Clinton, would rubber stamp anything that we wanted to do. And then when Trump came in, we thought, well, maybe, just maybe, we can get him to play ball. We can work up fake dossiers. We can do things extra judiciously. And if he doesn't play ball, well, then this is how we're going to go about it. Right? That's what they did. That was how it happened. So in saying that, we're at a particularly dangerous time in history. We have the economic breakdown of the United States, which is coming. It's coming. When our money begins to be repatriated, this is going to be a problem. And it is increasingly also looking like NATO is going to provoke a war with the Russians. All right, this missile in Sevastopol, on this island, some people got killed there, civilians got killed. I don't want to dive too deep into that one. It was a U.S. ATACMS missile that was launched. It was intercepted by a Russian interceptor battery, and some of the debris did hit the island, and it was a military target that was being targeted. It's beyond me how people are just partying in a war zone. You know, I don't know. It's strange to me. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, it's less than what it is. It absolutely is. I think it owes much to the fatalism of the Eastern Europeans that are out there, the Ukrainians, the Russians, the belligerents that are involved in this. They have a very different culturally. They have a very different and a very bleak outlook on life. That's interesting from a sociological perspective. Very interesting. But anyway, I'm kind of rambling in there. But you know, that's really, as BRICS is picking up steam as an economic alternative for the developing world, and China's influence is completely unabated, okay, completely unabated, we're quickly approaching a time where this hubris that Washington, D.C. has exhibited in its imperialism has now really caused some problems. And that ineptitude that has been fostered along all these years, really, the warning signs, the major cracks in the dam happened in at Hamid Karzai Airport in 2021, and it's only gotten worse from there. And believe me, the rest of the world sees this for what it is. And Joe Biden, like, we could lay the blame completely at the feet of Joe Biden, and it wouldn't matter, because you have to understand that Biden is nothing more than a sock puppet for the powers that be, for the senior executive service. Okay, that's what it is. And that Politburo is controlling things, and these are a bunch of useless old men who have only ever been exposed to self-enrichment through the government and kissing the ring and making their way up through the politics, the internecine politics of how all this stuff works, right? And they are so insulated from the ramifications of their bad decisions and their bad policies, they genuinely don't know. Right, they don't know what's about to befall them. The American people have had enough of this. Okay, we've had enough of this. And right now, I think that there's a good number of you out there who are only going through the motions, waiting for this thing to fall apart. But the larger point here is that is fascism. It is not communism. Okay, it is not communism. We have private corporations that are running things. It is not the will of the people or whatever they decide to call it, right? No, it is absolutely not. So, and just because it's not necessarily your brand of fascism, because you don't identify with it, it doesn't, you know, there's no people out there goose stepping around. No doubt and no less does it make it fascism. All right, and fascism is not necessarily nationalism. It is absolutely not. I am an American nationalist. I am an American first nationalist. And that is not fascism. That is patriotism. Okay? That is patriotism. You show me a man out there who doesn't stand up for his country and who doesn't put his country first, and I'll show you a coward. I'll show you a man who isn't worth a damn. I'll show you a man who should be stripped of all levels of influence he's got. Because if he's not willing to stand up for his country first against all others, then that's a coward. And if it took Nixon, or only Nixon could go to China, right? Or so the saying is, why did it take Nixon? Because they knew where Nixon stood. Mao Zedong knew where Nixon stood. Nixon knew where Mao Zedong stood. And when you know where people stand, they're easier to deal with. There's no bullshit. There's no patting the palms. There's no compromise on that. You're going to get the genuineness. That's what you are going to get. So, going into this election season, things are going to continue to unravel. What does this have to do with the InfoWars case? Because there is no justice system anymore. And, the Ukrainian flag bio people are perfectly happy with shutting down any contrarian speech. They have absolutely no problem with that. No problem whatsoever. Instead of in the court of public opinion, the open square exchange of ideas, so we keep being told, instead of going that approach and defeating an idea, saying, hey, no, that doesn't work, and here's why. Instead of doing that, we just say, well, no, we need to silence you. Right, we need to silence you, and we're going to continue to see that. And it is something that both communism and fascism have. This is a trait that they both share back and forth. Because a bad idea is very easy to defeat. The libertarians, it's very, very easy to defeat that ideology. Because it doesn't stand for anything. And because it doesn't stand for anything, it falls for anything. It's very easy to defeat that. But when you're looking for intellectual loopholes, you have to challenge your own ideas. You have to read things outside the box. You have to challenge your own position. So you come up with a new one. But the last thing that you ever do is give validity to that challenging position by simply banning it. And I'm not talking about banning certain books, pornographic books and what have you. No, no, no. You know, when you're targeting children, you know exactly what the hell I'm saying there, right? That's got to go. But what I'm talking about is banning free speech, banning inconvenient speech. That's where alternative media comes in. And I want to say that there would be no alternative media as we know it today without Alex Jones. There wouldn't be. I mean, there were others before him. There may have been other radio show hosts who've been more polished than Jones, more well-spoken than Jones. That's kind of part of his shtick, to a certain degree. But he is the father. He is the godfather of alternative media. There would be no Radio Contra. There would be no, the independent podcasts that are out there. There would be none of that without Jones. And they know that they are going to come for him first because he is the marquee brand. He is the marquee brand. He is the top. He is the most important voice in the room because of his stature and because of how tirelessly he has worked all these years. And if they can do it to him, they'll do it to me. They'll do it to you. They'll do it to all of us. It has set such a dangerous precedent to where you can shut down speech you don't like simply for the fact that you don't like it. That's exactly what has happened here. He was never charged with libel. He was never charged with slander. Not in the criminal sense. It did not happen. It was all a civil trial where you need a preponderance of evidence. And if you look at exactly where they need it, which is 51%, by the way, you do not need a unanimous jury. You only need 51%. And when you look at the venue where this trial took place, the instructions to the jury, all of the irregularities there, look at what they did. Look at what they did. They were out to get him. This was a show trial. Trump's trial was a show trial as well. Was it fair and impartial? There's nothing fair about that. And again, it was a civil case, not a criminal case. There was no criminal case. The criminal case in Atlanta is falling apart before your very eyes. You've got the top judge in Atlanta right now. The top judge in Atlanta who just got removed from the bench. Why? Hood rat. Hood rat behavior. You got to be kidding me. You have to be kidding me. So, does anybody expect anything different from the justice system? No. No, not at all. And to those out there who will say, you know, the system of governments, maybe the reason it failed is because it was flawed from the beginning. Our system of checks and balances, constitutional republic. It's not that it was flawed. It's that we allowed the wrong people to interject themselves into it. A republic relies upon a populace who is copacetic and congruent on society's goals. You cannot have that when you have competing groups. You cannot have that when you have an uneducated and stupid populace. We have both in America. Now we have people here who just flat out invaded the country and are being allowed to vote and will be allowed to vote in our next election. Mark my words, It is going to happen. It's happened in every one of them up until now. And if you think anything's going to be different, well, I got beachfront property to sell you in Nevada. Pennies on the dollar, it's a steal.
Why Kate Farms Nutrition Shakes will help support you on your journey. For starters, this high-calorie shake provides nutritional support for weight gain. Each shake is carefully crafted with essential vitamins and minerals with no dairy, soy, or gluten. Get 25% off your first purchase with code AUDIO. Exclusions may apply. See katefarms.com for details.
Folks, you know, and it is a cliche thing to say, you know, restoration of the Constitutional Republic, but when you look at Pinochet, and when you look at Francisco Franco, that was precisely what both did and what they were able to do. And that's what it might take. I'm not so sure, but I do know that we have some dark times ahead, and that's why you need to get yourself better prepared. So shifting gears just a bit, I want to talk about fighting carbine. And fighting carbine, so we had 24 trigger pullers. 24. It was, this was the biggest fighting carbine course that I have ever taught. And to be quite honest, I was a little intimidated by that because, you know, the average fighting carbine course is 15, 16 trigger pullers. I think the next biggest one behind this one was 18, and that was last June, if I remember right. And, it was a little intimidating to have that many people. And it was really a function of, you know, the class sold out. I'll say probably 2 months ago it sold out. The scout courses online, through the store, the scout course dates are coming up. The one in September in Missouri and the one in October here in North Carolina have both sold out. Huge classes, you know, huge classes. I had 30 slots in both of those classes and they both sold out. So that should give you an idea of, you know, how many people are getting out there and getting the training and taking it seriously. You know, it's very awe inspiring. And I wanted to share that with all of you out there because this is really, really awesome to see it grow. And it's not even like, I'd say it's not even from a, like a business perspective or anything like that. I'm just really, really inspired by how many people are getting out there in our community in the heat, uncomfortable, you know, heat. And I'm telling you, on the range during fighting carbine, it was 96 on Saturday. It was 97 on Sunday without the heat index. That was just the raw temperature. The heat index was over 100 on both of those days. You know, if you've ever been out on my range here in North Carolina, there is almost no shade down there. You're in a big hay field that you know, I've got my range on. So you got a big hay field. And it's, you know, it gets hot as hell down there. I didn't once hear a complaint. I didn't once have anyone in class quit because I have in the past. I've had people, you know, hey man, I'm burning up, dude. You know, like I'm used to, gravel pits and being sitting right by my truck or like, you know, whatever, you know, pampered kind of shit that, you know, people do. You know, some of you people do understand that, you know, being in a gunfight is not, I'm hanging out on a flat gravel pit with my fucking targets right in front of me, right? Like you do know that. I hope you know that. If you don't know, I'm telling you, and if you really, really don't know, then you know, maybe you're, unfortunately, you're probably going to learn the hard way. But it's inspiring to me to see so many tough bastards coming to class. I mean, getting out there, getting after it, bearing the heat, bearing being uncomfortable, getting out there, training their ass off, learning stuff, seeing it click, and then, you know, in after hours, burning it down. I mean, you know, I had a guy ask me, one of the guys in class, I had him ask me on Sunday morning when we were just kind of sitting around, we're eating a little bit of breakfast and getting ready to hit the range. And he asked me what my favorite part about teaching and, you know, running Brush Beater Eyes store and podcasting and the websites and like what out of everything, what's my favorite aspect to it? And I told him flat out, hanging out with the boys, like during class, you put in that work, you're doing all the good stuff on the range. And then, you know, those after hours, when you get to hang out with the boys, everybody lets their hair down. You're just there to have a good time, man. You know, and guys drink a couple beers, smoke cigar, you know, sip some fine whiskey, whatever it is. And we're just hanging out and you enjoy that time with like-minded guys, you know, because we are so buttoned up in our day-to-day lives that getting out and enjoying that time with one another and building those human connections, we just don't get enough opportunities to do that nowadays. You know, if you think about it, that's we really don't. And I think on that note, that's kind of one of my big gripes about a lot of these firearms guys and whatever, that, you know, social media types that only exist online. That's kind of one of my big gripes about them is that they don't, what are you doing? You know, are you getting out there with real people? Are you even a real person? You know, there's a few of those guys. I genuinely wonder, like, you know, you see them, you know, you'll see them on YouTube or, you know, wherever, Twitter, whatever. Is this a real person? Is this even a real person? I mean, I know that, you know, the guy in front of the camera obviously is a real guy, but is he who he claims he is? I mean, in this era, how do you know? You know, how do you really know? All you really go off of, honestly, for the most part, is what people tell you. You know, that symbolic interactionism, kind of taking another term of from sociology, baseline level sociology, symbolic interactionism. And we take people at their word, right? You know, but I kind of think about it like if you're not getting out there in front of students regularly, you know, real people, you know, I mean, all that flippy twisty, you know, sped up doctored videos and shit that you're doing, I mean, you know, maybe that might impress the little kids that are watching your bullshit, but that don't impress me. And it doesn't impress anybody that really knows anything. Cause it's like watching Steven Seagal fight. It's phony. It's fake. Who gives a fuck? You know, has anybody, you know, have you ever seen him really fight anybody for real? No. You know, it's not like Chuck Norris and Bruce Lee. They were actual sparring partners. You know, their fight scene was real. You know, that was real. But anyway, I digress. Let's talk about fighting carbines. So the guy's getting after it, getting out there, getting after it. And one thing, a couple of stuff here that I wrote down, because I'm a copious note taker, as a lot of you know. Everywhere I go, I have a notebook and I have scratch paper with me. I'm constantly writing stuff down. Every time that I get a free moment, I'm going to jot something down of note. And there were a couple of things here with fighting carbine that you know, I want to revisit. I want to reiterate. One of them is And coming out of class, kind of a training methodology and what I use and where I'm coming from in all this. I'm a less is more kind of guy. You know, in three combat deployments to the Middle East, I learned a lot. And we learn our best lessons from our adversaries. Our adversaries that we didn't defeat, by the way. You pick up tips and tricks and tools from them. Because there's a reason that they were successful. And there's a reason that I wasn't, right? And I say I know, as part of, you know, United States coalition forces and, you know, all this jazz, right? Cool, groovy. But at the end of the day, you know, I could lay blame at the feet of politicians, or I could lay blame on, you know, for our losses on a lot of different shit. But you know what? I lay the blame at my own feet. Because being a man entails taking responsibility. And, you know, we didn't necessarily fight the way that we needed to, you know, but you have to take that responsibility. And when you begin to become aware enough to take that level of responsibility for yourself and your role in failure, which is what the global war on terror was, it was failure. It was profiteering on one hand, and it was failure on the other. But in doing so, you open your mind to learning lessons. And one of those lessons that really stands out to me is the lesson of positive identification, or PID. You know, a lot of times when we were thinking of a AQI, Al-Qaeda, Iraq, Al-Naq Shabandi, which was an insurgent group in Iraq, in central Iraq, in 2006 through probably at least 2012, at least. They're probably still around in one way or another. Who knows? Have zero desire to go back and find out. But when we thought about their fighters, we thought about guys that are, you know, all kitted out and, like, you know, dressed to the nines and kind of thinking about some sort of, like, facsimile to American warfighters. You know, how we're all kitted out and, you know, we're ready to rock and roll, right? Body armor and all the shit on. Well, when you start thinking about it, in an insurgency, you know, we were looking for that when the reality was that, you know, the guy that was shooting at us, or the guy who was putting the IEDs in, he was a farmer, or he was a store owner, or he was just, you know, whatever, workaday dude living his normal life, moonlighting as an insurgent. But as soon as the job was done, he was taking all his stuff off, right? So a lot of times these guys would have stuff that they could just drop and run. And they know that if you can't get positive identification on them, hey man, you know, whatever. I'm just another face in the crowd. There's many such cases. So when I train and when I am, you know, as I look over at my everyday carry handgun right here, whenever I select weapons for a purpose, that's always in the back of my mind. You know, how do I look like everybody else in my working environment? Because that's, you know, like the prepper sphere and, you know, certain, we'll say, tactical voices out there love to throw out, oh, I'm the gray man. Oh, I'm the gray. I'm a gray, you know, this, I'm the gray that. You ain't gray. Wearing them 511s, you ain't gray, period. Wearing the cool pants, you know, the K-U-H-L, cool. Right, wearing those. Hey, they're nice and all. I don't own any. You ain't blended in North Carolina in those. You know, maybe if you go hang out in like Asheville or something, you know, you might. But generally speaking, rural areas, man, you stand up like a sore thumb. You know, look at footwear. This is something my mom used to teach me when I was growing up, and she was exactly right. But the essence of being a gentleman is what your footwear looks like, you know, because your footwear tells you everything about a person. You know, what class of person are they generally? And I like kind of using that. That's a, you know, if you really think about it, I know like somebody might insert a Forrest Gump joke in there or something, but it's no less true. I mean, she was teaching me that long before that movie came out, you know, and you can tell a lot about people based on their footwear, their clothing selection. And again, that is, you know, our symbolic interactionism. We define people based on that image that they are putting forth, right? And our clothing selection shares with the world what we want them to know about us. There's some sort of image, there's some sort of role that we want to portray, whether we're doing it on purpose or not. The result is the same across the board. So what we're trying to do is defeat positive identification on one hand. The other hand is that in Fighting Carbine, the whole course is built around manual of arms, right? Understanding the manual of arms. This is going to dovetail my next point, but understanding the manual of arms. So, you know, we don't need to add complications in there. We don't need to add, you know, 80 pounds of tactical gear on top of that. If your job every single day doesn't entail wearing all that crap, don't wear all that crap. Simple as, okay? If you're a civilian, and hell, even if you're in law enforcement, you don't need to be rocking around with an IBA 24/7. And in fact, the reality is that if for nearly all of us, when we get into a defensive use of force encounter, which is likely, okay, it's likely. And I tell people in class, I've been involved in more defensive use of force encounters as a civilian than I did when I was in the military. Now, I have lived in some pretty shady places, right? You know, Fayetteville, North Carolina, pretty shady spot, right? You know, and anybody that'll tell you, you know, any combat vet, real combat vet, that'll tell you out there, oh yeah, it was every day I was shooting and blah. No, maybe like when you were invading the place, but most of the time, nah, man, like that's not how it goes. You know, so anytime you know I hear, there I was, you know, a lot of times it's okay. You know, you listen to whoever that is telling you that story, and you kind of just blow it off, but. Point is that there's a lot of dangerous bastards here stateside, and there's a lot more of them now. It used to be that you knew who they were, you knew where they lived. If you grew up local to a place, any given amount of time, and you know, you weren't sheltered by suburbia or any of that, you know, like I definitely wasn't, and you're indoctrinated to poverty, you know, from a young age, and all that goes along with it, the street crime that goes along with it, the culture around it, then you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And when I say defensive use of force, it could be anything. It could be a fight. It could be a stabbing. Could be, you know, a melee, you know, group fighting. Could be drawing a handgun. Right. Any of those things. But they all have something in common. It's all violence. And usually, in my experience, you don't get to pick and choose. Now, there's going to be action cues, right, that are going to happen before that fight goes down. There's going to be the lack of eye contact. There's going to be the shit talking phase, right, which is the psychology of a fight that's going into it. But there's warning signs. There's cues. Right. If you're in tune to it, you're going to know, you know, if somebody doesn't make eye contact with you, that person either sees you as a threat or you are the threat to them. Right. Or they're the threat to you. That's what I mean to say. So you got to learn to fight and get comfortable fighting in what you are going to normally wear. And so for me, that's going to be a pair of Wrangler jeans or Ariat jeans, right? They're about the same. Ariats are built a little bit better. They last a little longer, and the back pockets are deeper, which is actually really good because they will completely fit an AR-15 magazine inside of them. So you could actually stack two back there, and they're going to sit back there real neatly. Wrangler jeans, not necessarily. But you need to know how to fight in what you normally wear every single day. I mean, the guys who show up on the range with the RoboCop friggin' holsters, when are you ever going to wear that in a real environment? All right. Are you going to wear that thing when you're going to get gas? No. I've been in a defensive encounter getting gas. Okay. It happened. Dude pulled a gun on the guy behind him, the next pump over from me. You know, could go further into that, but we're running long, right? But that happened, right? That happened. That, ironically enough, that happened a few years ago, right before I fought a carbine course that I was getting ready to teach on a Friday, literally a Friday in the middle of the day. But in a Sheets parking lot, interestingly enough. But the point is that, you know, you're not wearing that friggin' huge drop leg, doggone, you know, RoboCop holster around in an everyday setting. You're just not doing it. You're just not doing it. A friend of Kay's who was coming up to help him teach gunfight concepts, and I'm you know, not going to share his name, but I will say that, you know, he's retired from the Army now. He was in CAG for a long stretch of time. You know, Delta is really, really awesome guy, and he knows his shit. When he's out instructing on the range, he's literally got a small inside the waistband holster for a SIG P365, and that's what he's rocking. And that's the same handgun that he's using regardless of, you know, whether he's gonna be all kitted out for, you know, something crazy or just everyday carry, you know, here in Central North Carolina. And it's the same. And he gets used to wearing that weapon, training with that weapon, that same setup, right? You know, just kind of carrying it right there, strong side carry right behind his kidney, and bam, you know, good to go. Now, of course, the internet Gucci gurus are going to tell you that, you know, oh, that's ineffective or that's slow for whatever reason, or like all these plethora of arguments, which may or may not be valid. Who knows? Who really cares? The results are what cares or what matters, right? And the results are is that he's effective in a gunfight. He knows what works for him, and he doesn't need anybody telling him any different. I've seen him run his weapon system. Bam, it works, right? Period. End of story. And so you have to be able to do that with layering up as well. So if I can fight with what's basic on me, then I'm going to be more effective with anything else that I'm going to be using. All right. So if I need to add kit to the mix, what's the purpose of a chest rig? Primarily to carry ammunition. It's not there for any other reason but to carry ammunition. Other stuff, all the fluff needs to be on your body, and maybe you could throw another pouch or two on there for, you know, whatever other little bell and whistle doodad, gadget, widget, whatever, right, that you're going to be putting on your kit. Extra weight, generally, in my experience. I'm a less is more kind of guy. But there you go. There's a time and a place for body armor. Not always. Okay, and there's never a place for steel body armor. Never. That's, again, another conversation entirely. But I want to say that the other takeaway from fighting carbine, and that, you know, you can see those guys, when it's hot as shit, there's a reason that I do the course that I do, and I do the ones I do at the differing times of the year, and it's because when it's super-duper hot outside, and you're running fighting carbine, there's a stressor involved there, you know, because when you have that adrenaline dump that's going and you know, you're in a fight, you got to train yourself to do that. I mean, I remember when I first started wrestling as a very young man, I didn't know, and I grew up farm work, throwing hay bales, football, right? And all of a sudden, I'm wrestling. I didn't know that I could sweat that much in such a short amount of time. Literally 2 minutes. 2 minutes. And I'm just like, holy crap. Gassed out. Right? I thought I was in good cardio shape. Bullshit. Right? Bullshit. I learned how good I wasn't. But when you're training in the summertime like that, you know, you're really fleshing yourself out. And you're figuring out where your weak points are in whatever it is that you know, your training program consists of. And you learn, you know, hey, man, I need to, you know, I really need to flesh my program out a little bit better to get myself better. It's a stress inoculation. And when you have that adrenaline pumping, that's definitely all part of it. You know, but really, in keeping your equipment simple, I want to revisit this with your rifle, right? Your individual selection of a rifle. There's a lot of people out there who have, you know, this setup and that setup and blah, blah, blah. And they have like all these different weapons and stuff. And I want to say, like, on one hand, that's not necessarily all bad, because I do that too. I mean, I have, you know, kind of a purpose in mind for one weapon, and I kind of have another purpose for another one, and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, I've got rifles with LPVOs on them. I've got rifles with prismatic optics on them. I've got rifles with red dots. But generally speaking, for most people who are on, let's say, you know, they didn't come from a combat arms background with multiple combat deployments and like all the cool guy shit. Like, let's delete all that. Okay. Because it's really not that big of a deal. I don't think so. And in fact, the longer I go, the less of a big deal I think that it is. But it does give you one thing, and that is a lot more trigger time in training than the average person out there. Now, I know, like, there's a lot of competitive shooters, and one of the really cool things these days is seeing just how many people there are that are actually putting in the hours. And that's awesome to see. Okay, that is awesome to see. And I am by no means, don't get it twisted, I am by no means slighting any of those people or any of that. I love that. Right? I absolutely love that. And, you know, I ain't better than nobody. Okay. But what I will say is that I have a baseline level of skill that transcends across, you know, I can pick up any AR-15 and know whether I'm picking up a quality built one or one that maybe they cut some corners somewhere on. And I can also diagnose issues with it that it may have very quickly. Okay, you need to get to that point. If you're not there, you need to get to that point. So keep your weapons simple. I'm not a fan of ambidextrous controls. It, you know, anything that changes the basic manual of arms is a problem. And yes, you can absolutely 100% run the AR-15 left-handed. I teach all the students to do it. Everybody that's come through fighting carbine has done it, to include magazine changes. Ambidexterity on day two is a big part of the training goal. Okay, because again, just like saying, we don't get to pick and choose generally where our defensive encounter is going to occur. We also don't get to pick and choose, going along with that, what we're having to utilize for cover. Okay, and we have to be able to shoot around cover. And in order to minimize our soft tissue exposure around cover, you need to learn how to manipulate that weapon and shoot effectively non-dominant side in order to be effective, you know, in order to remain in that fight. you know, these guys that are, you know, oh, strong side only, strong side only. Like, you're doing yourself a pretty massive disservice when you're doing that. So, you know, keep your weapon very simple. Had three guns go down in class. I will say that they were, one of them surprised me because it was what I consider to be a mid-grade AR. I'm not going to name any brands here. I'm not going to do that. I will in class, but, you know, I generally don't to the rest of the public. But there are a couple of low tier brands out there that, you know, I'm not a fan of, and that is what it is. And I have not seen one of them in particular. I have not seen successfully complete a class yet. I've seen guns with the lowers do okay, just to strip lowers from this company in question, but never a complete gun. Never seen one successfully complete class. And this course was no exception. Gas block issues. If your weapon is cycling sluggishly or slow, it's one of two things. It's either the usually if there's some sort of striking that's going on, resulting in metal shavings or whatever it is inside the weapon, it's normally a problem with your recoil spring and the buffer tube itself. Something is not correct in there, which is throwing the whole gun off balance. Think of your AR-15 piston, or your AR-15 bolt rather, as an engine piston, and you'll understand a little bit more about the mechanics of how the weapon operates. So just like when, you know, your engine pistons are going bad and the cylinder walls are going bad, or you're going to get metal shavings in the motor and, you know, you're getting ready to lock that thing up, your AR-15 is doing the same thing. So when your bolt starts running sluggishly, the first thing that I always check is that castle nut, okay, on the buffer tube. It needs to be properly staked. And a decently built AR-15, a correctly built AR-15, it's going to be staked. If yours comes from the factory and it's not staked, you need to take that to an accredited gunsmith. Don't be trying to do that shit yourself. Okay, I'm sure it's really not that hard. You take a roll pin punch and do it. Okay, cool. But I'm just telling you, when I've tried to work on my own guns, usually something's going to go wrong. Okay, you take it to an accredited gunsmith, I promise you it won't be their first rodeo working on an AR-15, and they know what they're doing. All right, they get paid to do a job, let them do their job. The next thing, gas blocks. So the first gun that went down had a problem with the buffer tube coming unscrewed. It came from the company that shall not be named and was not properly staked. We had an armorer's wrench. We were able to get the gun fixed, back up and running at the end of the first day. So I just handed him one of my rifles. It was a Colt 6920 Trooper, which I think now they're calling the Enhanced Patrol Rifle. It's got my buddy Monty LeClaire that runs Centurion Arms. It's got one of his handguards on it, and it's, you know, it's a Colt M4. Okay, it's a mil-spec M4 with a mid-length gas system on it and a free-float handguard. Right. Basic. Everything's mil-spec on this thing. No frills. Nothing fancy, but effective. And it works. Right. And it is repeatable in its performance. And so I stuck that in his hand. And, you know, he was able to finish out day one running a correctly built weapon. Well, we fix his rifle. We get him back down on the range. And it goes down again. This time it was the gas block. So the roll pin on the gas block, and he had a regular polymer handguard, the you know, the triangle front sight post. Okay, I don't think those are relevant anymore. But, you know, hey, everybody's entitled to their opinion. That's cool. You know, we can't all be right. I would rather have that retail space for enablers that, you know, IR laser, a light, if you're putting together an entry rifle, you know, whatever, right? I don't think that front side post is really that important anymore. But the gas block obviously is. And so it has to be properly put together. It has to be properly staked. And the roll pin that holds the whole assembly together, the gas tube into the gas block, must be properly set. Okay, if it is not, guess what? Your gun ain't gonna run. And if that thing walks on you, you're gonna have a problem. The AR-15 doesn't necessarily need an adjustable gas block. The reason that they exist is to fine tune it if you're going to be running it suppressed. I don't really think that, you know, in my opinion, based on, you know, having run countless AR-15s and, you know, tens of thousands of rounds through ARs, both suppressed, unsuppressed, you know, on the M4. I don't really think that's that big of a deal. And in fact, I've seen more malfunctions coming from adjustable gas blocks during fighting carbine than I have not. Usually that's the culprit. When you have a gun that's just not running correctly, the bolt's going too slow, and when you have the bolt going too slow, running too slow, it's under gassed, that's going to lead to double feeds. And usually on day one, before students learn malfunction clearance drills, that actually exacerbates their malfunctions because they're sitting there trying to monkey with the charging handle, not realizing that you're inducing a double feed when you do that. All right, that's a problem. So with that said, you know, an effective fighting weapon is a simple fighting weapon. It's one that you don't have to really monkey too much with. It's one that is reliable as well, because reliability is not just a mechanical thing, it's also a confidence builder. And if you're running a weapon that just is a piece of crap and won't run for you and is, you know, double feeding, you know, you're going to lose confidence in that weapon quick, fast, and in a hurry. And you're not going to trust it when you need it to really perform for you. So with that said, you know, those budget guns that are out there, you know, the dime store bargain bin guns just seem like they're too good to be true. They probably are. And even, you know, let's say higher tier guns out there that have a bunch of bells and whistles on them, and you don't really know what their purpose in life is, that might be a problem too. You need to have a basic AR-15 free-floated handguard. There's no reason not to have a free-floated handguard with a continuous rail across the top so that I can mount enablers up there. All right, with my optic, I can mount a clip-on thermal or a clip-on night vision device up front. I can have an IR laser on there for aiming when I'm under nods. I have a basic optic on there, right? You know, iron sights, I mean, you know, okay, I know a lot of people really like their flip-up iron sights. Never have I ever seen an optic fail in a quote-unquote combat situation where all of a sudden I had, you know, time to pop those iron sights up, especially if they're like a 45-degree offset. To me, that's just stupid. I'm tilting the plane of my weapon to shoot with a less accurate aiming system for what? Like, for what reason? That doesn't make any doggone sense to me. But what it does add is ounces to my weapon. It adds a complication that may also fail on me, because I've seen more iron sights fail in class than I have optics. That's a fact. Misaligned optic, or misaligned iron sights, rather. Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that several times. Somebody drops their weapon, thing takes a hard lick, you know, that front sight post is going to move. The whole base will move, right? Rear sights, I've seen those break. Carry handles, I know, like, retro stuff is a fad right now. Nah, there's no reason for that. For an effective fighting weapon, there's a reason we got away from that. Okay, there's a reason that Picatinny rails became a standard. this, I don't understand. Like it doesn't compute with me. Having a decent low magnification prismatic optic is probably about your best option that you can have. I love red dots, believe me. They're great for quick shooting. They're awesome. Rapid target acquisition, they're awesome. That's what they're built for. But when something is battery operated and it is battery operated only, that could be a problem, right? Having a little bit of magnification in there will go a long way. And so, anything in that 2x to 4x range, prismatic optics, and there's a lot of these on the market now. Ton of these on the market. ACOG, of course, is the most famous one. But there's a lot of them, and we've got some through the store, through Lucid Optics, Swamp Fox, so on and so forth, but there you go. Burris used to make a real good one. I don't know if they still do. There's a lot of options out there, though. A lot of options for that. And that's really, in a fight, having that little bit of magnification, and it reduces that level of complication on your weapon system, I think it goes a long way. It goes a heck of a long way. And of course, pay very careful attention to your mounts. That's the last thing that I'm going to say on this. Pay very careful attention to your mounts. An optic can be mid-tier, okay? Mid-tier is kind of what I consider like Lucid, Swamp Fox, Primary Arms, Vortexes, like their Strike Eagle line, kind of that tier of optic, the lower end SIG optics. That's what I consider that mid tier, right? They're not the cheap bullshit, but they're gonna get the job done and they're not gonna fall apart on you, generally speaking. But they do give up some things in terms of features, bells and whistles. But here's the big difference maker in my mind. You can have a mid-tier optic, but you cannot make up for the mount. You need to have the most robust mount possible for that optic and for that, whatever that enabler is, whether that's a light or a laser or whatever. That handguard needs to be fairly robust, not to the degree that it is overly heavy. There's some of them out there that I think are just ridiculous in the weight department. They're unnecessary. That Centurion Arms handguard from my buddy Monty LeClaire is just about perfect. It is lightweight, it is highly effective, and it gets the job done, and it's inobtrusive. In my opinion, that's probably about the best one on the market. So there you go. Fighting carbine, some of the takeaways from that, that same guy who had a, low end AR and it was not set up for what I would consider defensive uses. And I'm just going to leave it at that. It just wasn't set up for that. And he didn't know what he didn't know. And that's why he's in class, was there to learn. And so when his weapon went down on him, that's actually a good thing because it shows him that there's a point of failure here. And here's how we're going to fix it. And here's how we can diagnose that issue. And hey, man, let me put this weapon in your hands. And it didn't really cost that much more than the one that you're using. And yet, look how much better you're shooting with it. And that rifle, by the way, it had a, it's got a, the one that I put in his hands, it's got a Primary Arms 2X prismatic optic on it. And I'm going to tell y'all, and everybody that was in that class, he all of a sudden, it was like, especially by day two when we got to the barricade drills and we're running everything ambidextrously and we're incorporating a lot of movement into what we're doing. He was running that rifle like a pro. In fact, when he got to the left-handed side, the reverse nine-hole barricades, I'll have two of them staged, and I'll have one kind of the standard way that you're running primarily right-handed, and then I'll turn the other one around once we've got through our ambidextrous drills. And then you're moving, you execute a magazine change, you go to the other one where you have to run that barricade primarily left-handed to remain behind cover. So he ran that rifle wonderfully. I mean, like an absolute pro. And I was so proud to see that. And he was so empowered by that, you know? And then I had another student who his rifle went down, with a gas block issue. And I put another weapon in his hand. This time it was the one that I was primarily running. It's a Palmetto State Armory, carbine tip to tail. It is got a 11-inch handguard on it. It's one of the neater, kind of unknown ARs that they put out. It's a AR pistol, but it has an 11-inch barrel, 11-inch handguard, and I have a four-piece flash hider on it that's more like a single baffle sound moderator that's on it, and it eliminates all flash at night. Of course, I got my IR laser on there, designate IRV, and a mini red dot that's on it, and that's it. Like, that rifle is stripped down, and he was running that one, and I've got thousands of rounds through that thing. And he was running that rifle. And again, it was, or a carbine rather. He was running that thing like a champ. I mean, naturally, effortlessly, because it was properly built. And so when you have that weapon put together properly, and it is, you know, you've had a gunsmith work through it, and you're running it like that, it makes your drills smoother. It's going to make your confidence go up in that weapons platform. And you're just going to enjoy it that much more. You're going to gain that confidence with it. You stake your life on it, you know, at that point. So those are the big takeaways. You know, learning to fight in what you're normally wearing, right? You're what you're wearing every day, because we don't rock tactical gear in our everyday lives. Okay. You got to learn to fight in what's normal to you, whatever that is, right? Whatever that may be. For me, that's Wrangler jeans and a t-shirt, Wrangler jeans and a Pearl Snap shirt, right? That's how I'm dressed day to day. Okay. So if I'm not effective in fighting in what I'm wearing, then I'm not effective, you know? You have to have a weapon system that you have confidence in, and that confidence and that capability is garnered through reliability. And keep it simple, right? If you keep that weapon system simple, you're going to keep that platform simple, you keep the manual of arms simple, you have fewer points of failure, you're going to be overall way, way more effective, right? And then finally, know what those points of failure on that weapons platform are going to be, because they all have a point of failure somewhere, right? Somewhere. So real quick, want to talk about the show sponsors. Of course, BrushBeater.store. You can get everything that you need to be more dangerous over there. We have got full restock on night vision, and the stuff that's out of stock right now is on its way. Okay, it is on its way. So we've got plenty of gear, all the things that you're going to need over there, communications equipment, freeze-dried food, everything that you need to be more dangerous, we've got. BrushBeater.store. BrushBeaterGold.com. Economics and the economic turmoil facing the United States is at an all-time high. I think that we are in a lot of trouble, particularly the United States dollar. Take care of yourself. All right, start planning for the future. BrushBeaterGold.com. My partners over at Genesis Gold Group have a financial advisors team that is ready to assist you on getting into the gold market and in probably the best way possible to get into it. So check that out, brushbeatergold.com. Finally, last but not least, a new advertiser that we have in the shoot, brushbeaterbeef.com. You go over to brushbeaterbeef.com, you are going to find freeze-dried beef. That's right. Freeze-dried beef that is prime USDA choice. It is awesome stuff, and I have got some of it sitting right here. I'm telling you, a lot of the freeze-dried food out there, the common complaint that people have is that it lacks protein and that it doesn't, you know, it's very carb heavy, it's very salt and sugar heavy. Where's a lot of the protein in it? And of course, you know, the brands that I carry have tried to remedy all that. But at brushbeaterbeef.com, this is all freeze-dried beef. Okay, so this is straight protein. This is the answer to all your keto prayers out there. How do we store beef, a long-term freezer-free solution? Here you go. It is over there. Brushbeaterbeef.com. Folks, this episode went a little bit long, had a lot that I needed to get outgoing, and you know, here we are midweek getting some content kicked out. We will be on the air again tomorrow night, Sons of Liberty Live, and I look forward to having all of you. That is, of course, 2100 Eastern Time here on the East Coast, and you can tune in live on the Podbean app. God bless. Stay safe. Keep that head on a swivel, and I'll be talking to you all again very soon. Zensi Scout out.
When you've got a lot on your plate, your financial future is the last thing on your mind. You've got groceries to buy, gas tanks to fill, and your kid just got invited to another birthday party. How are you supposed to find the time or the money to invest? Let Acorns help. Acorns makes it easy to invest for you, your kids, and your retirement all in one app. Answer a few questions, and Acorns will recommend an expert-built portfolio that matches your money goals. Then, Acorns automatically invests your money for you every day, week, or month, whatever works for you. You can even start investing with your own spare change. Acorns is an easy way to invest for your future while you take care of today. Ready to give your money a chance to grow? Download Acorns now and sign up in just 5 minutes. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. Please consider your objectives, risk tolerance, and Acorns fees before investing. Acorns Advisors LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are provided to clients of Acorns by Acorns Securities LLC. Member FINRA SIPC. For more information, visit acorns.com.